Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to LSE for today's online event, which forms part of the LSE Festival, Power and Politics, taking place from Monday the 10th to Saturday the 15th of June 2024, and exploring how power and politics shape our world. Today's free lunchtime LSE Skills session is hosted by LSE Online. Each day of festival week, we are inviting LSE experts to deliver bite-sized professional skills sessions on topics covering inclusion, people management, decision-making, sustainability, and data regulation. My name is Donald McKenzie, and I'm the head of programs at LSE Online, where LSE's world-leading education is made accessible to a global audience. We provide a comprehensive portfolio of online programs to equip you and your organization with the knowledge and skills to advance in an ever-changing world. Our speaker today, Dr. Grace Lorden, oversees one of these programs, Inclusive Leadership Through Behavioral Science. I encourage you to check out this one and all the others. More details will be provided at the end of this session. I will now be handing over to Dr. Daniel Jules from the Inclusion Initiative to kick off today's session.
Hi everyone, my name is Daniel Jolis and it's my pleasure to be here with you today. It's the first day of the LSE Festival, Power and Politics, and I am very excited to be discussing is diversity and inclusion bad for business with the wonderful Dr. Grace Lorden. Now, Grace is the founding director of the Inclusion Initiative and an associate professor here at the London School of Economics. Grace's research focuses on inclusive leadership, women's progress in the workplace, the future of work, productivity through diversity, and individual success. Her academic writings have been published in top international journals, and she's written for leading business publications, including the Financial Times, Fortune, and Harvard Business Review. Grace is a regular speaker and advisor to blue chip finance and technology firms. She's also the author of Think Big, Take Small Steps and Build the Future You Want. It's her first book. If you haven't read it already, I highly recommend it. You can find more about Grace's work at her website, gracelorden.com. Now, I'm very excited for today's session. I cannot imagine a better person to be speaking to the question, is diversity and inclusion bad for business? So for context, we've seen recently a surge in popular voices on social media saying that DEI is bad for business. There's also been a significant reduction in investment in diversity and inclusion by some of the world's largest firms. Now, today, Grace will outline the logic behind these arguments, along with the conditions that cause diversity to be problematic for business growth. And by contrast, Grace will demonstrate the key conditions that are needed to reap the rewards from diversity in business. Now, for you, our audience, if you are on social media, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Festival. The event is being recorded and we hope it will be made available to you as a podcast at a future date. Now, as usual, there will be the chance for you to put your questions to Grace via the Q&A feature on screen. Please do include your name and affiliation. That will help me present your question. Please also feel free to type your questions in the Q&A while Grace is presenting and upvote the questions that you would like to hear during the presentation. So without further ado, I'd like to hand over to Dr. Grace Lorden.
Amazing. Daniel, thank you for that fantastic introduction. And thank you, everybody, for turning up for this first session of LSE Festival. Myself and Daniel, as people from the Inclusion Initiative, are absolutely honoured to be here with you. So I'm going to start with, is diversity bad for business? And then we'll add, is diversity and inclusion bad for business? And just to give you a little bit of context about how Daniel and I happen to be here talking to you, in November 2020, the Inclusion Initiative opened thanks to a generous gift from Lucy Lawler and Richard Nesbitt. And since then, we've had funding from UKRI, ESRC, and a number of other funding opportunities have allowed us to build a repository of research that allows me to speak confidently to this question. So please do check out our website. Lots of free papers to download and also lots of thought leadership as well if you don't have the time to read those papers. But to start with, is diversity good for business? I'd like you to join me in a thought experiment. I want you to imagine starting a new job today. You go to a new firm, and on the 9 o'clock on the Monday morning, it's your first time meeting your team. You've met the manager in the interview, but your first time meeting your team. So you go in and there's about 8 or 9 people plus the manager, and you sit, you take a seat, and you recognize very quickly, actually, firstly, that the people who are in the room are very similar to each other and different to you. So you see this in a very visible way. Potentially they're all from another country. Potentially they're all a bit a different gender. Potentially they're all a different age, but they have that in common with each other. And the second thing you notice actually is that this is a topic that you feel comfortable with. Your knowledge, your experience, your skills and talent up to this point allow you to speak confidently about this in the room. And I want you to imagine that the meeting starts and you're ready to kind of give your perspective and you raise your hand. And the manager takes a little bit of time to call on you. I would say maybe they're having banter with some other people in the room. It takes them a second to come to you, but they do come to you. But as soon as you start speaking, you're interrupted. You try again, 10 more seconds, you're interrupted, and it's not corrected by the manager. But you know that you have an insight that you really want to impart in this meeting. So you try a second time, you try a third time. Now, I want you to imagine leaving that meeting and you've never been heard. And actually, all that was discussed was one particular idea that was common to the group, and your perspectives never got heard. So you leave, and I want you to think about what you will do in that situation. So you go back to the next meeting. Are you somebody who will try again? Well, if you are, there is a subgroup of people who will do this, and they actually will embrace dissent in those in the meeting. Now, the interesting thing about this is that if you have a manager who's not listening, who's putting their hands over their ears and is only interested in their own perspective and that what is common with the group, they only want to have an easy life, then you won't be heard. Your dissent will actually cause aggravation in the meetings. The meetings might get longer. They'll get tenser. The environment might even be labeled toxic, and there's a negative impact on productivity. So in that case, it is bad for business. And if we replicate that across the company, where you have managers who embrace cronyism, who embrace favoritism, you will never hear the innovative perspectives of people who are sitting at the table. And those perspectives will never carry through to the firm. So on aggregate, you have this negative impact. Now, what's also common is that people will fall silent. So people fall silent inside in a room, and actually they might even get labeled by their manager as an introvert. Oh, that's Grace, the introvert. She stopped talking. Or that's Grace. She doesn't participate in the meetings. We're used to her. She doesn't like to be prodded. When the reality is you rationally decided to stop talking. And you've rationally decided to stop talking because why would you want to be interrupted when it's deteriorating your well-being? You might even stop skipping meetings in that case if you can get away with it. But ultimately, your voice is lost to the company. So in that case, we get a zero gain. And because in the context, you basically have a bunch of people who think the same way, sitting around engaging in cronyism, at the aggregate, this will either be neutral to productivity or actually negative when competitors outside the doors start using diversity to get an edge. So what else could you do? Well, you could decide to quit, and people do. We see this in our qualitative data that when faced with being excluded in an organization, people do decide to quit and go their own way, often into entrepreneurship because they get fed up of not being heard, but sometimes to another organization that has inclusive leaders. And again, you have this neutral or negative impact on productivity. It would be negative if other firms benefit from diversity and yours isn't, and you're not in a growth cycle. And the last, which has become really interesting to me, is conformity. So there are a number of people, and we've done large qualitative research studies now over the last 3 years. There are a number of people who, when they go into organizations and they click onto this dynamic, they recognize, actually, I need to feed my family. Housing is expensive. I need to make a living. So they'll play the game. And when they play the game, we lose their diverse perspectives. And actually, there's even some evidence that conformity can become permanent. So when that person gets to the end of the organization, they don't turn around and change the climate for people coming behind them, but rather they stick within the culture that they've managed to thrive in. So in this thought experiment, if you have somebody who's coming into a room and they're not being heard by the manager, you can have dissent, you can have people quitting, you can have conformity. You can have people being labeled an introvert, but ultimately being rationally silent. And in all those cases, it's bad for business. Now, even if there's a neutral impact in those cases between diversity and productivity, don't forget that same organization is probably spending a lot of money on diversity, equity, and inclusion. So in that respect, they're spending a lot of money and investing in it, but they're not reaping the rewards from diversity. And then I guess the question is, when is diversity good for business? So to answer that, I want you to come with me on a narrative about somebody who I met in real life, who I'm going to call John. Now, if you're sitting in the audience and your name is John, I can promise it's not you. Because this is a conversation about diversity, I thought it would be quite nice to remind you of a 2018 New York Times article that highlighted that the top jobs where women are outnumbered by men named John in the Fortune 500 as Fortune 500 CEOs. Now, what I always found curious about this article, because I always read the small print, is that there was actually, at the time of print, even more Jameses. So I always wondered why they chose to run with the headline of John rather than James. But nevertheless, if we move forward to 2023, things actually got worse for John after the New York Times article. So I always like to show this as a way of demonstrating the causal impact of the media. So you'll see that it ran in 2018, there was a decrease in the number of Johns, and lo and behold, because people don't read the small print, there was an increase in the number of Jameses and some increases in women as well. But just to reassure you that this is actually a synonym, let's go back to John, and I want to tell you about my experience with him, who I learned actually a lot from. So when I started the Inclusion Initiative, one of the first projects that I worked on was with Women in Banking and Finance, where we created the Good Finance Framework. And this was really a framework to think about how you can actually get the benefits from diversity, not just specifically women, diversity in its broadest sense, how you can get the benefits from diversity in financial and professional services. And I found myself being invited to speak in a lot of places. And one of these was a large financial company. And often it's common after the event, and this is why I wish we were together, I get my most interesting questions. During the event, I had said, it's up to every manager to equalize opportunities, visibility, and voice for their team, within their team members. And after the meeting, John came up to me, who was managing about 20 people, and basically said, you know, what you say is a really good in theory, and I can see why you say it. It sounds good. But actually, in practice, it doesn't really work. In practice, there's many people in my team who are stinkers. And that isn't the word he used, but I need to PG it. It's 12 noon at the LSE. But they're just not good performers. So if I was to start paying attention to them, then the productivity of the team would go out. And I say, how many people aren't, you know, good performers? And he reckoned four, maybe five people. And this was somebody who actually worked in finance, where he would pick companies to bet on, essentially, and needed to assess risk in a way. And it was a very concentrated portfolio. So those picks were very important. So strategic conversations were very important. So I asked him, I said, look, just do me one favor. For the next 6 months, for all the decisions, because his decisions weren't that frequent, for all the decisions that you make, keep making your decision in the way that you've been doing it. But this time, just get everyone's perspective and write it down. And carry on in your own decision making. And at the end of the 6 months, review the data and try to figure out whether or not you're missing any perspectives in those rooms. Maybe one of those four or five people will surprise you. So about 6 months or so went by, and John wanted to see me. So I ended up catching up with him at the LSE, and we had a conversation. I asked him how it went. And it had taken me about 3 days to get around to seeing him at this point. So he wanted to meet me on a Monday, and I think it was like a Wednesday or a Thursday where we met. So I said to him, you know, how did it go? And he said, well, it was really interesting. I realized I was ignoring way more than four or five people in my team, actually more than half of the people I was ignoring. And, you know, you were right. There was information in there that would really have helped me. One person in particular had this amazing perspective on risk that I didn't necessarily see myself. So it was quite a useful exercise. So I kind of said, you know, what are you going to do with this information? Because I expected him to say, well, I've reflected and I've changed my management style. But John did something that I wouldn't probably have advised him to do. And he went and told his team. And he just said, look, I've been ignoring a lot of people in this room, and that's going to stop. And I have this exercise now where if somebody disagrees with me, I'm going to write it down. And while I've done it privately, I'd like us to do this together. So at the end of so many months, we sit down, we do a postmortem, and we have a candid conversation where if I've been ignoring Grace or I've been ignoring Daniel, that will be revealed in the exercise. And for me, this was kind of a turning point of what equalizing opportunities, visibility and voice actually meant. And it really got me to reflect, and it kind of gave a piece to a jigsaw that I've been thinking about for a while on what explains success when it comes to diversity in business. And for me, John, new John, really explains that success. So essentially what he's doing is leading inclusively and tackling groupthink. And, you know, Donald mentioned that we have a virtual course in inclusive leadership through behavioral science here at the LSE. And this is exactly what we teach. So you learn about how to reduce withholding, which basically means the people who we've labeled introverts, we bring those voices into the table because they know that they're actually going to be heard. Also to reduce disrupting. You know, one of the running jokes I have is I've been asked almost 200 times now, Daniel, to come and give confidence training to people who don't speak up in meetings. And I've never once been asked to come into a room to silence people who actually speak too much. Now, I don't give confidence training, so please don't ask me to do it. But I always say to the firm, don't you think you should spend some time reducing disrupting? And the reason I say that is because this is how you can actually tackle groupthink. It's really weird if we're in a meeting and the same people speak for a long time in every single meeting. Yet this is something that you will see replicated across organizations and sectors all over the UK and all over the globe. Also, he's been promoting contributing. So making sure that people are brought into the table if they have fallen silent, reassuring them that he's actually listening to them. And even if he doesn't take on their perspective in that particular moment, they will have their day when he gets to say, you were right, 6 months later. But I think the most important thing that John is doing is that he's promoting processing and actively listening and really paying attention to people and not necessarily changing the solutions that they bring to them. But of course, all of this is all very well. But the other thing that he's doing is embracing diversity. There would be no point in John reducing withholding, reducing disrupting, promoting contributing and promoting processing if he were surrounded by people exactly like himself, if he were surrounded by people who were very similar to each other. Now, John in this story is actually quite lucky because he had quite a diverse team. He would just happen to be ignoring half of them, but he had quite a diverse team. He had the talent. But again, if I think about the virtual course at LSE, one of the things that we do is thinking about how you can actually hire diversely and how you can hire in line with the meritocracy. So really thinking about getting the best talent rather than someone who's just like you. But I think the other thing that we really have to pause, because it's linked to the conversation that we're having today, is that fundamentally John changed his beliefs. Now, I didn't change John's beliefs. John changed his own beliefs. I gave him a tool, essentially, where he would go and gather evidence on his own behavior and the results from his behavior, and recognizing that he was actually missing things that would help his team be even better. And I have to say, at the time, John's team were thriving. They were getting big bonuses. Now they just got a bit bigger. So in that sense, he wasn't necessarily the perfect person to take on this challenge. But he gathered his own data and he changed his beliefs. So when we think about why is there a pushback against diversity and inclusion at the moment, a lot of this is actually beliefs driven. So as human beings, we tend to ignore facts and evidence that go against what we believe ourselves. And we select and cherry pick the evidence that aligns with our beliefs. And the problem for diversity in business is that if you look at the literature, what you'll see is a negative link between diversity and firm performance, a neutral link between diversity and firm performance, and a positive link between diversity and firm performance. So if you are somebody who engages in confirmation bias, you can just choose the papers that actually align with your beliefs. Now, of course, through the thought experiment and thinking about John, the one thing that I kind of really want to get home is that if we don't have inclusion, if we don't have inclusive leadership embedded in the firm in the way that John is actually conducting it, you won't get the benefits. Instead, you'll have conformity, you'll have dissent, you'll have people falling silent, and you'll have people quitting your organization. You won't get the benefits from diversity. And what's really important to point out as well about John and his tactics is that it's embedded in the business and it's embedded in the day-to-day. HR haven't intervened to make John an inclusive leader. John has chosen to be an inclusive leader, recognizing the benefits to himself, to the team, and to the firm. So I think coming back to the question that was in the title, is diversity and inclusion bad for business? I think the answer depends on how you are defining inclusion. John's inclusive leadership style is good for business. So for me, a barometer on whether or not we have inclusive leadership within a team is asking two sets of questions. The first relates to equality of opportunities, visibility, and voice. So I like to look at that data within teams, look to see what the standard deviation is, which gives me a measure of how people have different experiences within the team. But I also like to look at it across measures of diversity that we know tend to have problems when it comes to opportunities, visibility, and voice. So we can look by gender, we can look by ethnicity, and then we can also look by any other data that the firm happens to have. The second thing that I like to look at is conformity. So really asking, do people feel that they can't bring their perspective into a team meeting? So if we go back to the thought experiment and we think about you entering that job on the first day, realizing your different perspective is going to be good for business, but not getting to say it, that can be captured in a survey question too. I think instead, inclusion within organizations is often captured by input-driven measures, which is a problem in general for the S and ESG. So people will ask about affinity groups, about employee resource groups, about things that actually happen within human resources or the management level, but don't necessarily relate to the core for the business. So until we have an inclusive leadership style like John, the gains from diversity don't go to the team. And we won't see it aggregated in the business. And I think before I finish, I also wanted to kind of address, why is there a pushback against diversity and inclusion? So, I spoke recently at a bank in London, and a gentleman put up his hand and he said to me, it feels to me, if I were to compare to somebody, 10 or 20 years ago, my career is much harder. It's harder to get promoted. It's harder to move forward. It's harder to get opportunities to grow. So it doesn't necessarily feel like diversity is working. And I think it's fair to say for this particular person who was in an organization that were cost-cutting, redundancies were on the table, promotions weren't necessarily as many as they were 10 years ago, that this person is right. So for him, had he been there 10, 15 years ago, the number of people in the race with him would have been less. And also the number of prizes that were on offer would have been more. So when we have a kind of contractionary period or a company is doing bad or there's financial distress, and there's also a push on diversity and inclusion, then there will actually be losers. And the people who are losing out do have a reason to push back. They have an individual reason to push back that shouldn't be ignored because it becomes part of the problem when moving ahead the agenda. I think the second thing is that thought experiment in the beginning, the outcomes derived are very, very common. Dissent, conformity, quitting, falling silent. And this means diversity doesn't give business gains and is also expensive if people are actually investing in things like having a big day out or having a tea for people in order to make them feel better. Might make you feel good in the moment, but when you go to your second, third, fourth, tenth tea and you realize nothing is changing, you can soon get a sour expression on your face. I think the third is, unfortunately, unlike John, D&I is majorly run out of cost centers and isn't embedded in the business as an advantage. So in downturns, this means that it will be cut. So this is why we see some pushback within companies. You have to have a narrative. People engage in confirmation bias all the time. Diversity isn't working. This is why we need to cut the initiatives. Instead, I would prefer people to start spending money on diversity and inclusion initiatives that are effective. And one of these is actually creating inclusive leaders and giving people like John, who are extraordinarily talented, extraordinarily competent, the skills that they need to lead in the way that the organization wants. The fifth, which I've already mentioned, much like the S in ESG, D&I progress is largely measured in inputs and not output and impacts. So there are very few papers actually that link diversity to output and link diversity to impacts. Those that are there and that are done in a very rigorous framework give me confidence that diversity and inclusion is good for business. And I think the last is a lot of the pushback is actually on equity and erroneous beliefs regarding equity initiatives. So when we think about equity initiatives, what we're really trying to recognize is that there's people who are outside organizations, outside we're not getting to them, who have skills, talent, and ability, and we need to do something to bring them in. So one of the effective ways to do this is to think about people who might be socially mobile, for example, and give them scholarships to come to university. They have just as high merit as everyone else sitting in that university. The only difference is the financial constraint has been raised. You could also think about equity, about women in the workplace. At the moment, in every country in the world, the average woman does more at home as compared to men. The average woman. I'm not saying necessarily saying every woman. And what this again means is that women will need to have more time out as compared to men. And when you have organizations that are thinking in the short run rather than in the long run, that becomes problematic. For me, I'm a really big fan of equity initiatives. And the two that I've raised, I would just like to remind everybody, we are investing in people who are highly skilled, highly talented and highly able. They just have different constraints. The first being financial constraints, the second being time constraints, as compared to other people who are in the labor market. And they are absolutely, absolutely worth the investment. So I'll pause. I know I had 20 minutes and I went slightly long. I'll pause just to have my Ask Me Anything slide. And I do hope that there's some wonderful questions in the chat. And I will pass back to you, Daniel, while I stop sharing my slides. Thank you.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Grace, thank you so much. It was a great presentation. I love the story of John, and I think so many of us, myself and so many in the audience, I think we've been in that room, and some of us have maybe been there as John and some of us have been there in the audience, and it's a great story about how we can promote inclusion. I think there are a couple of questions that are coming through in the chat. I'd just like to say to your audience, please do send through your questions. Once again, you can just type the short questions into the Q&A box. We're going to try and answer as many as possible. And again, just include your name and affiliation, but please keep the questions coming through for Grace. So Grace, the first one I'd like to ask, it comes from one of our LSE alumni in Bangalore, India, Vinti. Thank you for your question, Vinti. So Vinti is asking about when it came to John's story, what are the reasons why you wouldn't have necessarily recommended that John share what he was doing or his process with his team in the way that he did? What was your initial hesitation, perhaps?
Well, I think my nerves would have come from backlash because he was actually ignoring over half his team. And that is how he said it. So I can imagine myself in that situation where I would say, I'm now ignoring, you know, I've been ignoring half of you. You might imagine another situation where people wouldn't have necessarily been so forgiving of this person. It wasn't on my mind, but I guess the other thing people might say is that there's probably legal reasons, right? Because potentially there's people in his team who could have said, well, you've held my career back by not giving me opportunities, visibility and voice. But I will say, and I think, you know, I kind of changed my mind, Vinti, which I think is one of the kind of wonderful things about working in TII. My openness to changing my mind has fundamentally shifted as well. But I think this really links to a literature on vulnerability that shows that vulnerable leaders are ones who increase psychological safety, more than others. But I also think for him, it gave this big moment because he had been somebody who would have made up his mind about something and used a meeting basically to talk himself, then leave and run with his own idea. So I think it was maybe a lightning rod moment for the team and why it worked. But that wouldn't have been the advice that I would have given. And I need to think about whether I would give it now, even having learned a lot in the last number of years.
Terrific. Thank you. Grace, another question. I'd like to ask this one nice and early because you might need some time for it, perhaps to reflect on. But this comes from Claire in our audience from Q5 Partners in London. And Claire's asking if you have some examples of really great equity initiatives that you've seen.
Yes. So, I mean, here at the LSE, I'm involved with the Ugla Scholars Program. And I think that, you know, when we think about people who are coming to university who mightn't have gotten the opportunity to go to fee-paying schools, one of the first things we think about is changing financial barriers. And LSE for a very long time has been wonderful about changing financial barriers for extraordinarily talented students to come to the LSE. I think how the Ugla scholarship is different is because Lance, and you know, we do some of this within LSE, and also he himself does it outside the LSE, really is interested in also changing the networks of the Ugla scholars. So giving them opportunities to be exposed to different people who can ultimately change their luck in the future. Because, you know, a research on luck tells us if we trace luck back, it often is to people who we know in our network who are thinking about us as being skilled, talented and able people. So for me, when I think about equity at the very kind of beginning of the pipeline, I would love to see more programs that don't just give financial scholarships, but also give this kind of networking support, mentorship that also comes along with the Oogle Scholars program. I think the second thing I'd say is, because the other example that I actually gave when I was talking was about specifically about leave. And I think specific to people who want to take off parental leave, I think it's a really bad idea to leave it in the hands of one manager and human resources. I think there's really good evidence that, you know, human resources always back up the manager. And if a manager isn't particularly good, you could actually lose that talented person right at the moment when they're the most vulnerable to leaving, which is when they're taking time off, when they have young kids. So for me, and again, we wrote about this in the Good Finance Framework, having three people who are responsible, and particularly one person who is at least kind of one row down from the executive, bearing in mind this burden probably can't fall to the executive. So thinking managing directors in finance, for example, again, this is an effective way to make sure that even if the manager isn't particularly good at helping that person at that moment, that you'd have somebody else who's there as well.
Thank you, Grace. I'm fortunate enough to be part of the Oogle Scholars Program in small capacity, and I can attest to how valuable it is for those students in building their networks. And also as a parent, I've seen firsthand the difference that really good parental leave can make when it comes to careers. So that's great. I'd like to ask a question that's come from Megan. It's been upvoted, and she's asking, how can you promote the kind of bottom-up inclusive leadership style without necessarily having it come top-down?
So, I mean, I'm after mentioning the course like twice now, but I feel the type of courses that we're doing here at LSC are really, really pivotal. So for me, a lot of times I end up talking to people who are quite senior in the organization. So directors, managing directors and executive level. And what I really want to be talking to are the people who are kind of starting their journey and are sure that they're going to stay, but aren't managing people yet, or people who have really, really small teams. So kind of much earlier in their careers. And I think we can't teach inclusive leadership training that's decoupled from productivity of the firm. And I think that's a mistake. So much of the thought leadership on diversity, equity and inclusion that's out there is about diversity, equity and inclusion that has nothing to do with the firm's output. And I think, you know, there's room for that. So I don't want, but it's very unusual to me that we're talking 95% plus of the literature that ignores that when we get diverse people who are kind of sitting together, we do get gains for the organization. So for me, I do want to see people either self-train themselves or pursue courses like the one that we have at LSC, which teaches them how to manage diversity, where there might be conflict, where there might be decisions that need to be made, where they're not as straightforward as John. So you'll never know whether or not the quality of the decision was good or bad later on. How to hire, how to recruit in line with the meritocracy. And I think that's what we do differently as well, is that we are really concerned with there's errors being made every day in organizations with who to hire, who to give opportunities to, who to give voice to, who to give visibility to, and teaching managers how to self-correct those. So you could, if you like, Daniel, which mightn't be a good marketing point, but you could call it meritocratic leadership. But it's really about making sure that we're not just choosing people who are like ourselves, or we're not just choosing the loudest person in the room where errors come. So for me, the answer to that question really is people need skills to lead inclusively. But the second part, which is also something that we do, how will they know that they're working? Because I think up to this point, diversity, equity and inclusion has been so expensive. So if you're giving me tools in order to change the dynamic in the room, how can I be smart and know whether or not what Daniel told me is the right thing to do? And again, that's something that the course does. It gives you lots of potential solutions, but also guides you on how you can actually evaluate them.
That's terrific. Grace, you've spoken there a little bit about the links between diversity and improved firm performance. And I think we have a number of questions in the chat a little bit around this theme. You've spoken a bit about what leaders can do within their own organisations. But how do you see the relationship between inclusion, diversity and organisational financial results, and maybe even the research evidence that we see at the moment in this space?
So I think a short answer is that we don't see it, Daniel. I think it always astounds me that people spend so much money on initiatives that are related to diversity, equity and inclusion and don't track what they're actually doing for the firm with respect to any measure of firm performance. It doesn't necessarily need to be earnings. It could be innovation, for example. But not only that, very often people don't track how effective those interventions are with respect to the goal that they set to that they were trying to fix. So I've seen interventions that have been created, for example, to retain women in the middle of their career, and they haven't looked to see how that's actually changed attrition for women in their career and how it's attracted new women. And I guess that's kind of the movement that TII wants to make by talking to people who show up to events like these, is really to say that's very important and it can be done. And yes, in some teams, it's going to be harder than others because the outputs aren't going to be that well defined, but it still can be done. It will be noisy, but it still can be done. So there's few papers out there that really do credibly link diversity and inclusion to performance. And as I kind of said when I was giving the talk, the ones that are robust with respect to causality. So there's a really good paper that looks at the impact on quotas in Norway, for example, and shows that the quality of women who went onto the boards were equal or better to the men that they replaced. It also demonstrates that when the hard quota came in, a number of firms chose to delist because they didn't want to hire women into senior positions. And also that the stock price actually went down, but after a very, very quick period, I think it was a week, it did come back up to baseline again. And I think it's been net positive if you take the medium view rather than the immediate view. But this is really what I would like to change. So me as Grace, when I'm changing my management tactic, I shouldn't assume that it's working. I should be looking to see, okay, am I getting more ideas? Are different people talking? Am I giving opportunities to people that I wasn't necessarily giving before? But then at the firm level, they want to see whether or not the net impact or the aggregate impact was actually positive. And that's something that we really want to encourage.
Fantastic. I'd like to switch tack a little bit and ask, there's a question that comes from Sasha in the chat. And Sasha is asking about the impact of unconscious bias on artificial intelligence. I know that I've heard you speaking about artificial intelligence and AI, so I'd really like to hear your thoughts on the impact of unconscious bias on AI.
Well, yes, because I mean, artificial intelligence just takes things that we've put out there, and we know that human beings are unconsciously biased. So I've been playing around with them. I've been playing around with ChatGPT, and you can kind of think about types of careers that might be typical of certain types of persons in our society. And there is a tendency to choose those names. And, it kind of just perpetrates what we've actually done before. I think that's the risk. So I worry about it. I worry that the people who are creating artificial intelligence aren't diverse, that they will be able to overcome some of these challenges. But I don't think that this is something that cannot be surmounted with some thinking about bringing kind of diverse people together from across the world. So I worry about it. At the moment, people aren't doing anything about it. But I think that the unconscious bias that's embedded in artificial intelligence can be turned around. And I feel a bit more confident making this statement because in my class that I taught in January, some of the exec students wrote on exactly this, and they had some great ideas about how it can be tackled. And it does involve getting people from across the globe involved in having conversations around whether or not something is biased or not that's coming out of these algorithms, and inputting into the quality of the delivery of these algorithms. But it is surmountable. It is surmountable with effort. And I think absolutely worthwhile, because this is where society could potentially reset.
Yeah, terrific. On the theme of voices from around the world, I'd like to share a question from Carla, who is a student in Mexico. And Carla is asking about voluntary standards and mandatory legislation and how effective they are in pressuring organizations to create a diverse and inclusive environment.
So I think that there's a really neat graph that shows the impact on hard policies, soft policies that are just recommendations, and no policies. And I think that the voluntary policies on diversity have been shown to be as effective, but not as effective as the hard policies. It's exactly what you would expect. And if I were to think about that kind of from a theoretical perspective, that would be the conclusion that I would come up with. And if we look at the evidence that comes from really gender and ethnicity, I don't think we know anything beyond diversity on those dimensions or inclusion. But within those dimensions, they are effective. So if you're in a country where doing something like a hard quota is politically not palatable, you could think about doing something from a voluntary perspective. And, you know, women on boards who are a friend of the Inclusion Initiative that's run by Vivian Arts now, they've done an amazing job of actually increasing the amount of women on boards. And again, this isn't necessarily a hard quota.
Terrific. You spoke there about the number of women on boards. And I know when we spoke about John's example, we also spoke about the prophet in his team. We have Alejandro in the audience who's asked, how do we effectively track diversity and inclusion interventions and I guess how well they're performing?
I think that's the million-dollar question at the moment. So if I have 5 years to spare in TII going forward, I really want to think about the S and ESG because I did a discussion on it a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of people who have thought way more about it than I have were in the room. So it was a privilege for me. And one thing that really emerged from that is the frustration that when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion, we've been too focused on input-driven metrics. So what that means is that if I'm thinking about something inside the firm, for example, you know, I might say having more diverse perspectives around the table increases the quality of the decisions. But the reality is what I'm counting is what the diversity looks like around the table. And we have very little evidence on the quality of the decisions. Or if you could think about for firms who actually are doing things that are out in the community, what they might want to do, for example, is give financial acumen skills to people in the community so that they can build businesses in a way that's more effective. And very often when we look at the ESG, when we look at the S and ESG reporting, we look to see who got them. So it would be by diversity. Was there enough women? Was there enough men? What did it look like with respect to ethnicity and race? What we don't learn is then how did those skills change the trajectory of those people? And I think that's what's problematic. So at the moment, all of the tracking is pretty much on an input-driven basis, which leads people to be frustrated with organizations because of virtue signaling. So, you know, I can say that I have employee resources groups. I can say that I have money that's devoted to having a big evening to bring diverse perspectives together. I can sponsor some awards. But ultimately, what am I doing to change the dial inside companies, like with John in this perspective? And what I'm interested in is measuring inclusion using metrics outside of the firm, which I'm doing with a number of colleagues, including Teresa Almeida, who's one of my good colleagues in the Inclusion Initiative. But I'm also interested in how can managers like John measure that their changes actually make their team more productive? And I think if we can incentivize managers in that direction, then at the firm level, we will have much more information about how diversity and inclusion is impacting the firm.
Terrific. And Grace, you spoke there about incentivizing managers. And you mentioned Teresa. Teresa has actually got a question in the chat. It's been being heavily upvoted as we speak. So I'd like to take the opportunity to share it. But Teresa's asking about interventions that might be effective in actually getting those majority groups or those groups that you spoke about who feel like they're losing out. How do we get them on board to support DEI initiatives?
So people like John. Is what she's talking about.
Or any of the majority groups in the organizations. You spoke also about the ones who 15 years ago opportunities may have seemed easier to them.
Yeah.
Things feel a bit harder. How do we win those people over into support DEI?
So I will be careful and say that there's a lot of people who are in the majority group who do actually care a lot about diversity and inclusion. They're real allies. And there are people who are underrepresented talent who care less about diversity and inclusion. I've had those conversations as well, right, where people would say, I've heard women say, I don't want to hear anything more about women moving up in this organization. It's all by merit. You know, I care less about it. So the people like the old John, moving them to the new John, what we're really trying to do is change beliefs, right? So if somebody is up for the experiment like John, that's perfect because they get to track they get to track their own data. And if you look at the if you look on the literature on changing beliefs, people discovering it themselves through their own exploratory work is about one of the most effective ways that we have to change beliefs. Now, you might look and say, Daniel, well, that doesn't make any sense because there's people who will never do the exercise like John, and I'm absolutely on board with you. So the second best solution we then have is to create leaders like John within organizations, not just people who care about inclusion, but people who are using inclusive leadership to make their team more productive, to make themselves and the team look better. Now, those people, if you think about people in organizations, I like to think about them in three different types. You have the champions of diversity and inclusion, and they really, really care about diversity and inclusion, irrespective of whether it has productivity gains, irrespective of whether it moves profits. You have the people like John who are like, well, I'll do it if there's something in it for me. I'm not against it, but I'm not for it. So, you know, those people. And then you have the people who are really dead against it. Now, people shift their beliefs through those three different types. And I'm interested in the people in the beginning, because the evidence that we have is that if we manage to get between 30 and 55% of people doing something differently in firms, now that could be stealing stationery and everyone ends up in a very bad place, or it could be leading inclusively like John, but the other people do follow. You get what they call cultural tipping. And I've never seen an example in a firm that's convinced me that we need more than 55% or less than 30%. I think the literature really is right in that. And I'd rarely say that. I'm usually skeptical about these numbers. So for me, within organizations, there's two things that I'm interested in doing. One is creating more people like John just because. Because, for example, Daniel, even if LSE was quite a toxic place to work in as an environment, you could be happy working with a manager who's like new John, because you are led inclusively. And LSE is a wonderful place to work, by the way. That was just my first. I can see the logo, so it was the first thing that I thought about. But even in that situation, you're happy with the manager. So you're giving a gift to a team by creating an inclusive leadership, regardless of what happens in the organization. But if you manage to get more people like John, so, you know, LSE can train them, for example, or somebody else can train them, or you get lots of people to self-learn, or it's done in-house. But if you manage to get to 30%, 40%, 55%, somewhere there, the magic happens where other people change their mind. Because it's hard to continue being a jerk, hiring your friends, engaging in cronyism, if the tone from the top is saying that it's not okay, and if the if a decent percentage of you of people around you are leading that way. So I think that's kind of the on the ground, that's the mission. Even if we just change one leader, then that team actually has a better experience, but it won't do much to the productivity of the firm. But if we manage to change more than one leader and we get to that magic number, 30 to 55%, we get cultural tipping. And that's something that I'm really, really excited about.
Terrific. I mean, you've spoken there about creating more inclusive leaders. There's a comment in the chat from Daksha, who's done one of our inclusive leadership courses at the Inclusion Initiative at LSE, who's just said it was an excellent experience and it's really helped thinking. So please, anyone in the audience today who'd like to get involved, please follow up help become one of those 30-40% that can lead the tip. I'd like to ask a question from I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. Dooney, who's working in architecture in London, and is asking about these scenarios that you spoke about where perhaps employees are just falling into the conformity route because they don't feel like they're going to have a voice. And so Dooney's asking, well, how do we tackle that, and how can we spot it, if you like?
I mean, a lot of people will know themselves that they're conforming. So I know this. I've conformed myself in my career and it doesn't feel good. You feel, you know, you're not getting to be, you feel like an imposter. I think this for me should be the true definition of imposter syndrome, where you conform in order to satisfy somebody who doesn't make a lot of sense, like old John, because you're not really sure what to do. There's no other way to get ahead. I know that lots of people in our qualitative research have talked about conforming. So when Erica Brodnock did interviews with Black women, conformity was a very strong theme. When I did interviews with people with private equity in a project that was joined with Nikita, again, conformity was a very big theme that came up there. in the 200 diverse voices that we're working on now, the data is quite young. So I wouldn't say it's across the entire 200 diverse voices, but I know it's definitely been in a lot of the transcripts that I have read. So I think people know themselves that they are conforming. I think that what people don't realize is that if you conform over the long term, that's probably going to become who you are, right? Because if you repeatedly do things over and over again, you do become that person, whether it's a good type of yourself or whether it's a negative type of yourself. I think from the manager, they need to be paying attention about whether people are always just giving them back the same idea that they're putting into the group. And I think a very starting point for that is not to give your idea when you really do want people's perspective on a particular project or a go-to. So not to go in and anchor people to your idea. And I think if you feel very passionately about something, like you and I worked together on Generations, and I think that there was maybe two questions that I really wanted in the new survey, I would be very honest with you and say, look, there's two things that I really want, but I want to hear loads of other ideas because I'm really excited to hear from other people too. But I think that honesty as well, it doesn't mean, because you know straight away that what I'm saying is, look, I really want to hear your perspective and your ideas going into the project. But actually, there's two ideas that she wants and she's being honest about that. I think that honesty is very important. I think if we take a step back for me, as well as the manager not giving their perspective, I think looking at meetings and paying attention to who speaks and who does not speak. And if you're sitting in a meeting and you're meant to be the chair, or you've assigned a different chair, but it's ultimately your responsibility to create a good dynamic in that meeting, and it's always the same people who are speaking and always the same people who aren't speaking, that's problematic. But if it's always the same people who are speaking and agreeing, then you do have a conformity problem. And it's either one of two things. You've chosen to hire people who are dominating your room, who are too like you, which isn't good for you, because you may as well have a conversation with yourself. Or the second one is that people are actually pretending to be like you to get ahead. And then it might be hard to differentiate between the two of them, but by simply not giving your ideas and saying in the beginning, I don't want repetition in this meeting. I want to hear as many unique ideas as I possibly can, because this is the brainstorming stage. You'll learn quite quickly whether or not the people who have been agreeing with you have unique ideas that they've been hiding.
Yeah, I really like that, withholding the idea and also encouraging the different ideas. I know for me personally, I'm someone who worries a lot and I can get straight into the details. So if you've withheld an idea from me, then it encourages me to share more and it stops me from starting to worry about the idea from the onset of the meeting. So I'll take that one away myself and have a think about it. I think we've got time for one more question from the audience. And I think the one that I'd really like to go to is, I apologize, there's a couple of others that have come in thick and fast. So I might have lost that one. So I'd like to go perhaps to finish on the current backlash against DEI and perhaps woke culture and how you think this has impacted organisations and their DEI efforts.
I think it does. I mean, I think, and I'm actually in some ways, if what the DEI backlash does is get people within organisations much more savvy with what they fund and paying attention to what's effective, so that we continue to move forward organizations with respect to diversity, equity and inclusion, maybe that will be a silver lining. All we know at the moment is that it's cut funding. It's cut funding. We can see in there's some data that we have in the Inclusion Initiative that Teresa, Almeida and I are actually working on that shows that the number of people who had diversity and inclusion in their jobs increased substantially after the murder of George Floyd, but also has decreased substantially. And I think if this were in a room, I would ask Teresa to kind of give the numbers. But I think even more than what the decrease was bigger than the increase. So I think the answer is yes, we can see jobs being cut. I know the programs are being cut within organizations. I know that organizations that look to advance people by ethnicity, LGBTQ plus status, by women are reporting that people aren't sponsoring them as much. So the funding has been cut. I think what we need to make sure is what we keep moving forward with are creating people more like John, because then that won't be impacted by some person on Twitter or X talking about things in a negative impact that, in light that they actually know nothing about. Let's be quite clear. Very extraordinarily talented individuals in investing, perhaps, or in setting up companies, but so far as I know, not diversity, equity, and inclusion experts. It wouldn't be impacted by that. But I think at the moment, because a lot of this sits in cost centers, because companies are struggling, because the gains to diversity, equity, and inclusion haven't been particularly big for the investments that have been going in, I'm not surprised by the backlash. I'm not surprised that it's after getting legs. And for the next generation, what I really want are people who are created to be leaders in the style of John, where they actually care about diversity, they care about being challenged, and ultimately they're not hiring themselves because they know that that perspective is covered in the organization. They're hiring people who have very different perspectives to themselves.
Grace, I think that's a great place for us to end our Q&A today. I want to say a big thank you. Oh, go.
Can I just, because I couldn't see any questions until just now, and there's one from Rania. I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly, and it's a brilliant question. So it says, earlier in the presentation, you gave one consequence for the lack of inclusive leadership is that employees lead and head to entrepreneurship to be the leader they want to see in the world. From the perspective of the economy rather than the firm, is that a bad thing? And I think the problem, Rania, is that all of this is interlinked. Because if you look at the money that's going to diverse founders, so if you compare by gender, by ethnicity, by some other characteristics, it's really, I mean, the figures are so skewed. So I'm happy for people to leave, but we do need representation in those top jobs in partnership and private equity. We do need them in investment banks because we want people to recognize the talent who go to become entrepreneurs when they knock at their door looking for funding. And, you know, if you think about, okay, as an entrepreneur, you can be a genius and have a genius product. If you don't have enough capital, if you don't have enough liquidity, it's going to be really hard for you to make a go of it. So that's why when we focus, a lot of the time I focus on sectors that don't just change the job prospects of the employee themselves, but can fundamentally shape and shift who is invested in our society. Sorry, Daniel. Yes.
Thank you. I think as we come to close today's session, we've got a couple of minutes. I'd just like to invite you to give any closing thoughts that you might want to leave us with today.
Yeah, you know, I think for me, I'd love you to connect with us. If you've come here, you can find me on LinkedIn and you can connect very, very easily with us through the Inclusion Initiative. We have some research that will come out. I think it'll be August or maybe early September that will demonstrate that diversity and inclusion is good for business. So earnings, share price, innovation. And I hope this will really change the conversation regarding whether or not diversity and inclusion is good for business. So next year, if I'm invited back, I can simply say yes, send you the paper and leave. For me, I think a lot of this does come down to measuring inclusion within the firm along the lines of how many Johns do we have? How many people do we have who are making sure that opportunities, visibility and voice within the organization is equalized? And I'll say again, because this was something that was set up by my colleagues in Extend Education to talk about online learning. We really have a wonderful virtual course that doesn't cost a lot of money that can get you going with this. So if you know a John who would like to do it or you would like to do it yourself, please do think about applying. And the last thing, if there's somebody who is struggling with a leader like John and having a really bad time in their career and has fallen silent or who has conformed, Daniel mentioned that I wrote a book, Think Big, Take Small Steps and Build the Future You Want. And this was really written from the perspective of the individual. So if you do come across bad luck, how you can actually survive it. Because I think, unfortunately, many of you in the room are going to have a bad manager, a bad time at work, experience things that you weren't necessarily expecting. And that book is all about controlling what you can control. So with that, I'll pass back to you, Daniel. And thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming. And please do stay in touch.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Grace. It was a great discussion. I hope everyone has enjoyed it. Thank you for your questions. I just want to say that there are lots more exciting events coming up this week at the LSE Festival. So do check out the program. The links are on the screen at the moment. I also want to give a plug for one of tomorrow's festival skills sessions. It's with Dr. Luke Schneider on how to make better decisions. So we hope to see as many of you there as possible. A big thank you again, and please do get in touch with us at the Inclusion Initiative at London School of Economics, and you've got the links through to find out further information about Grace's work. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.